Heads up, this podcast contains explicit language. The sleazy lawyer Saul Goodman was meant to appear in only a handful of episodes of AMC's Breaking Bad. Instead, Saul, played by Bob Odenkirk, became an integral part of the series and eventually earned his own acclaimed spin-off prequel, Better Call Saul.
After six seasons, Better Call Saul has now come to an end. A slew of memorable new characters, plus some old favorites from the Breaking Bad universe, have come and gone. And in this tense and meticulously paced origin story, we've witnessed the complete transformation of Jimmy McGill, the small-time crook, into Saul Goodman, the overconfident fraudster. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Aisha Harris. And today we're talking about Better Call Saul on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us today is NPR's TV critic, Eric Deggans. Welcome back, Eric.
That's right. Better call Eric, right?
Yes, indeed.
I don't want to admit how long I've been waiting to say that.
Well, the time has come. So most of Better Call Saul takes place several years leading up to the events of Breaking Bad. The show operates on multiple wavelengths. On the one hand, it's a legal drama. Bob Odenkirk plays Jimmy McGill, a struggling public defender in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who later becomes Saul Goodman, a scumbag lawyer and accomplice to drug lords. Ray Seahorn plays Kim Wexler, an ambitious lawyer and eventually Jimmy's wife. Together, they delight in plotting out and pulling off successful scams that grow increasingly elaborate and high stakes. Now, in the sixth and final season, their most ambitious scheme yet involves Howard Hamlin, an arrogant law firm partner and longtime nemesis of Jimmy and Kim, played by Patrick Fabian. We see the long-term consequences of their actions play out in black and white flash-forward sequences, where Jimmy's living under an assumed identity and working at a Cinnabon in Omaha, Nebraska. Really great product placement there, for the record. And then there's the underworld of drug trafficking and an eclectic cast of characters. There's suave kingpin Gus Fring, played by Giancarlo Esposito, and his right-hand man, Mike Ehrmantraut, played by Jonathan Banks. Better Call Saul was created by Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould. Season 6 was released in two parts this year and concluded this week. Now, a warning to our listeners that we will definitely, absolutely, yes, we'll be talking in depth about the finale in addition to the show as a whole. So if you are not caught up yet, come back to us after you are. You got it. That's your warning. Let's go. It's less than 24 hours since this finale aired at the time of this recording. I'm sure we're all kind of still processing this. But Glenn, let's start with you. What are your just like right off the bat feelings about the way Better Call Saul wrapped up?
Well, I think we should start off by letting listeners know that to accurately reflect the finale, we will be breaking for a commercial every six damn minutes. That was my main takeaway, that broadcast TV sucks. AMC, make that paper. Okay. This was a somber ending, a satisfyingly muted ending. And that's the ending I was hoping for, frankly. Not just because the show has always been about people talking with bursts of violence, sure, but it's always been less reliant on the pulpier stuff that Breaking Bad was about. Despite all the cartel stuff on the show, it was always more grounded in the gears of the legal system. So that's how it needed to end. And yeah, because if the show ended with a bunch of gunfire mowing down some Nazis, it just wouldn't feel true to what the show was.
Yeah.
And speaking of people talking, we do get a fake out midway through that this show, this finale, is going to be about how resourceful good old Slippin' Jimmy is. He's going to come out of this whole experience talking his way down to just a 7-year sentence. And had that happened, he'd have gone back to being the same guy he was in Breaking Bad once that sentence was ended. He doesn't, though. And once again, the show smartly places so much of its emotional weight on the performance of Ray Seahorn.
Yes.
When Jimmy walks into that courtroom to accept the plea deal, she's there. She's giving him nothing. He confesses his role in Walter White's drug empire, which surprises his lawyer, but doesn't surprise us because we knew he was going to do that. She's still giving him nothing because she wasn't there for any of that. That's not why she's there. And that moment, that lack of response from her causes him to re-engage with his humanity. He talks about Howard. He talks about Chuck. And Odenkirk is doing a good job modulating his performance to show us, to signal to us that this is not a bit, this is not patter, this is real. And then he turns to Kim, and once again, in a performance of micro-expressions, the tiniest acknowledgement he gets from her, almost an imperceptible not. And that's the payoff. That's all the payoff I needed.
Yeah.
I'm happy.
Yeah, I have a feeling we'll be talking a lot about Ray Seahorn here. But that moment, especially the way there's just like a very, very brief flicker of not a smile, but like an acknowledgement.
Yeah.
And we've seen that on her face before. But in that moment, it's just, you're right, that payoff is chef's kiss. Eric, your thoughts?
You know, I was worried about where this was going to end up because the show essentially becomes a slightly different show about four episodes before the end, when it really starts to focus on Gene, Jimmy, Saul's present day. But what's interesting to me about the finale is that it sort of cements this idea that Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul kind of are about the same journey, which is these toxic men finally admitting that they really are toxic and owning up to what they've done and accepting the consequences of what they've done. And in Walter White's case, it was death. And in Jimmy's case, it's life in prison. But eventually, because they want to earn the love of the people who are closest to them, they face who they really are. And I talk about this a little bit in the piece that I wrote for NPR.org. I had this conversation with Vince Gilligan a long time ago when Breaking Bad was still on. And I said to him, you know, it's been really interesting to watch this character who's a high school teacher whose soul is slowly curdling and is becoming this terrible drug lord. And he said, you know, you should think about it a different way. What if all the things in society that make you behave the way you are suddenly fall away or aren't a part of your life anymore, and you just become who you really are? That's what's happening to Walter. And once he told me that, I began to see everything in the Breaking Bad / Better Call Saul universe very differently. And that's why I love this finale so much.
Yeah. This finale, so we, in addition to being set in the, I guess, the present day for the show, so the black and white, we also get multiple flashbacks. We see him interacting with his brother Chuck, who, you know, died midway through the series. But we have that brief moment with him. We also have another moment with Mike and with Walter. And first of all, seeing Walter in this scene, we had seen him show up a couple episodes prior with Jesse. But to see him here, I was reminded of just how terrible he is.
Yeah.
He's acerbic. He's cranky. He's full of himself. And it's an interesting choice for Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould to sort of choose to have to only show Walter as like the worst parts of himself when we do see him on Better Call Saul. And there's a moment where Walter says to Jimmy, like, where Jimmy's trying to talk about how their regrets and whatnot. And his regret is like hurting himself at one point or injuring himself while kind of trying to pull off some sort of, or turning it into a scam of some sort. And Walter's just like,
so you were always like this.
And is it on the nose? Maybe. But it's also, to me, kind of encapsulating the entire struggle of this show, which is like, how much of this is Saul being a product of his environment and the things that have happened to him, whether it's his relationship with his brother, or we know that previously he had more or less scammed his father way back in the day. So how much of it is him being a product of an environment, and how much of it is just like, this is who he is and his compulsory, like he can't help it. Like no matter what he does, he always has to go the extra mile. He has to do that extra scam. For me, the way I see the show is that it is always in them. Like it doesn't necessarily mean it's in all of us. Like the ability to do these things is in all of us, and it shows up differently in each of us. And I think that's also very true of the relationship with Kim as well. And to see how she has always sort of felt to me like a character who thinks she's doing good, unlike Jimmy, but then she takes all the wrong ways to do it. And I love seeing the fact that like her compelling him to finally admit and be honest is like, that's what drives him to ultimately repent in a way that Walter White never could. I mean, what do you think of Kim after this? Like, we've had so many great moments with her, and I don't think she's the moral compass of the show per se, but she is a moral compass. And, you know, I think that her evolution has been very interesting to watch. I'm curious what you thought about that whole dynamic.
You know, what I liked about the Kim character is that she wasn't the moral center in the way that you might have expected. She might have refused to get involved with things and sort of condemned Jimmy for the choices he was making. The thing that makes Jimmy who he is was inside her too. And what she realized is that when they were together, it was like an exponential kind of explosion of con artistry that visited the worst sort of collateral damage on the people around them, and she couldn't be a part of it anymore, which I thought was a much more interesting choice. She was giving up the things that she loved and that she was good at because she realized that the toll of them being together and living that life was too much. Now, I will say, I interviewed Gilligan and Peter Gould and Odenkirk before the show even started airing. And one of the things that Peter Gould, the co-creator of Better Call Saul, said to me, and he wrote and directed this final episode that we're talking about, he said, back then, 2015, one of the central questions of the show was going to be, why be good? Mm-hmm. Why be a good person? And what's interesting to me is that the show answers that, you know, so that you can have a clean conscience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The difference between the villains on the show and the anti-heroes is that the anti-heroes are tortured by the terrible choices they make. And they're tortured because they have a conscience.
Yeah.
And so the show is sort of an argument for having a clean conscience. And what's interesting to me about those flashback scenes that we see in the finale is that it's just an example of all the people in his life telling him, there's something messed up about you.
Yeah.
And you need to face that. And also, the Walt and Saul interaction very much mirrored how Jimmy reacted to his brother. Mm-hmm. We were encouraged to view his brother, Chuck, and his criticisms of Jimmy as something that seemed unfair and that seemed overly harsh. He said,
I know what you were, what you are. People don't change. You're Slippin' Jimmy. And Slippin' Jimmy I can handle just fine, but Slippin' Jimmy with a law degree is like a chimp with a machine gun.
And now we realize, yeah, he was right. Mm-hmm.
I love that point about like the question of why be good, because while thinking about this, I went back and I rewatched probably one of my favorite moments from the entire series, which is in season two, the first episode, Switch. And it's sort of the moment where we see Kim realize how much she enjoys the things that Jimmy does. And so they're at this hotel bar and he overhears the stock trader talking, like just being a stock trader, just blabbing about stocks.
Short it. Short that shit. That stock is useless. It's got no legs.
And they pull up this fantastic scam to get him to convince him that they're interested in investing. And meanwhile, all they want is $50 shots of this tequila.
Look, an uncle on our father's side recently passed, and he left us somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.4 million. And I don't mean to be greedy, but I think if we invest it smart now, we could double it, triple it. We could quadruple the whole inheritance, right?
It's a great scene. And you see that moment of recognition because this is her first time really coming in on a job with him like that. And I love that moment because it really plants the seed and it really shows that like this is something she loves to do. And we get a little bit of that in season six, too. There's a flashback where we see that when she was younger, she's caught shoplifting with her mother. Okay. And so we see that this is something as a young kid that was already inherent to her. Now, I do want to talk about the fact that this is such a slow burn show. I don't know what your experience has been with it, but mine is that I watch Breaking Bad. I've seen the whole series. I watched the finale live, but I haven't gone back and rewatched it since. And I've been watching Better Call Saul since it started. A lot of time has passed. And so watching this show has been an experience where I'm just like, am I supposed to know this character? Do I remember this character from Breaking Bad? And this is a show that's definitely taught, I think, especially because there's also been so many lulls in between seasons.
Yeah.
Like, how has that affected your experience? And, like, do you think you want to go back and rewatch rewatch it in order? Because I think the show lends itself to binging more than it does to watching in real time. And that's absolutely maybe my hot take.
Yeah. I mean, even though it's only been six seasons, it has stretched out over 7 years. Yeah. And so there's entire plot lines, entire storylines from the beginning that I completely forgot about. The entire storyline where Mike is a bodyguard for Danny, who's played by Mark Brooks, who plays Colin Robinson on What We Do in the Shadows. That was so funny. And even though Chuck was in the beginning, you don't forget, like you can forget Danny, but you can't forget Chuck. Michael right. McKean's presence kind of looms over this entire show. And it was so great to see him in the finale. Now, what the show did inherit from Breaking Bad is a deliberateness. I mean, the showrunners say they love a process-oriented storyline, a commitment to depicting events and processes. But it's always a risk because, you know, in the finale, we'd get a long shot of people walking down a hallway and I'd be pausing it and saying, we have 6 minutes left. What are you doing?
Yes.
We are riding that line between deliberateness and self-indulgence, which is something both shows do. You can be teasing the audience, you can kind of, or you can be kind of being smug about how much power you have over the audience. And that's always the tension that these shows ride for me.
Yeah.
I mean, the choice to do the series at all is amazing. But when you see the full breadth of the series, it actually leapfrogs back and forth between after Breaking Bad and before Breaking Bad. And so I couldn't even imagine trying to binge watch all of like Breaking Bad and Saul in order.
Yeah.
In terms of when things happened, because Breaking Bad sort of happens inside the world of Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
It is such an ambitious undertaking. And, you know, so many shows ask so little of their viewers. It's amazing that they trust the audience enough to keep up with this stuff.
You know, in many ways, it's a scam. It's a heist show because we are constantly being in on these schemes that Jimmy and Kim are putting on. And the way they film it is that, like, usually in a heist movie or a show, they're going to explain before they do it how it's all going to go down. Mm-hmm. And then the payoff is that you are going to watch it go down and then see how it gets screwed up in some way because you already know what's happening. But what they do here is that you have no idea. You are just along for the ride. And like you were saying, Glenn, it could be 3 minutes. It could be 5 minutes. It could be an eternity. Sometimes it feels like you're literally watching paint dry. But like... It is so compelling because you are not quite Jimmy, you're not quite the scammer, but you're also not quite the person who's being scammed. So you're like in the middle and you're trying to figure out where it's going. Even this season, that entire long con with Howard is just like, first of all, it's crazy, but it's also just masterful the way they make us sort of try and piecemeal everything as it's happening over the course of not just one episode, but several episodes. Mm-hmm. And so I just really admire, you know, sometimes it does test my patience and it's frustrating. But overall, like, I really did wind up trusting it at the end. And I think that for me, I want to go back and rewatch Breaking Bad and then come back to Better Call Saul again. Because I think that's really the only way to do it unless you really try to timeline it and like intersperse. I'm sure there's people who are engaged enough and who want to like actually try and watch it in the timeline that it happens. But I don't think that that's possible.
Well, see, that's the fascinating thing about the show, because the show began with a very clear split between Jimmy and Mike, two separate storylines. You had the legal stuff, you had the cartel stuff. But then Mike starts shuttling between those storylines. And a bit later, Jimmy starts shuttling between those storylines. And then the murder of Howard Hamlin is the moment when they become one story. One story invades the other. And that's the moment. If the showrunners wanted, the show could have become a cartel show and had a much flashier ending. Instead, that murder is the first step toward tying up the cartel story very quickly, very, very, very quickly, so that it can become the Jimmy and Kim show again. And so that is, even though it seemed at the time really sudden, it had been building to that, but it also propelled the show toward the ending it had.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, is it better than Breaking Bad? Because, you know, I myself definitely, when I heard that they were doing a prequel, I was like, oh, really? Come on. Why? But obviously, we all really, really think this show is great. And I'm curious what you think about how it stands when you hold it up next to Breaking Bad.
I don't know, man. Because, like, we just now, as of last night, have the show as a complete whole. And we've had Breaking Bad as a complete whole to evaluate for years now. And I think I'm too close to it to be able to say definitively. I do think they're delivering two very different vibes. Yeah. One is kind of pulpy and noir, and the other, it's heisty and cartel. It's drama and relationship. I mean, like, it's different. I don't have an answer yet.
Yeah, and not only are the two stories different, I felt like I could feel Peter Gould and Vince Gilligan getting even better as storytellers as Better Call Saul kind of evolved. Breaking Bad, for me, I love the show from the minute I saw it, but the first three seasons of that show, I think, can be tough for some people to get through. Better Call Saul was at a higher level from the minute it debuted. And I think it's because, you know, it's the same team that created Breaking Bad, and they were just more adept as storytellers and more confident in the big swings that they knew they were going to take on the show. And then it just got even better as the series went on. So it's tough for me to judge because I feel like the storytelling in Better Call Saul is more ambitious even than Breaking Bad. And they pulled off more things and they took more risks and they told a more complicated, complex story. But Breaking Bad was the original And when you pioneer a kind of story like that, you have to give a lot of props to the fact that they tackled it at all.
Yeah. I don't know. I do think I agree with Eric to the point that it feels as though this was the creators hitting their groove. Mm-hmm. When I think about Breaking Bad, I think of it as like coming at the sort of tail end of the peak Difficult Men era.
Sure.
So, you know, the Mad Men's, the Tony Sopranos, The Wire, like all of that stuff. And Better Call Saul, in a way, sort of predates just slightly our scammer grifter era and sort of anticipates that. And so Better Call Saul feels to me like very much of its moment. And I am probably going to look back on it, I think, a little bit more in awe of it than I even what am with Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell us what you think about Better Call Saul. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Yes, I know there are so many things we didn't talk about. I'm sorry. We can only talk about so much. But up next, what's making us happy this week? Now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what's making us happy. Eric, let's start with you.
I was a professional musician many years ago, and one of my oldest friends from that time is a producer named Greg Pagani, and he has co-written and produced Chaka Khan's new single, Woman Like Me, and it is really a wonderful song, and it's so great to hear this vocalist, who is almost 70, still bringing it.
Awesome. So that's Chaka Khan. The song is called Woman Like Me?
Yep.
All right. Thank you. Glenn, what is making you happy this week?
Cult of the Lamb is a game that came out for various platforms recently, and it is entirely my jam. You are this cute little sheep who has been recruited by an elder god to form a cult in its name. So you gather followers and materials, and you gather materials by slashing your way through some very cute, randomly generated dungeons. The other half of the game is managing your followers. You build shrines and temples for them to worship you. You build farms and sleeping quarters and outhouses because they poop every damn where, and everyone's going to get sick if you don't build the outhouses. You need to keep their faith in you high. And I should be clear by now, at some point in the game, the line between cult and organized religion becomes a distinction without a meaningful difference. The aesthetic of this game is so cute. All your followers are these cartoony woodland creatures with giant eyes. And the design is really impressively deep because it gives you a lot of choices for what kind of cult you build, which really ups the replay value. So that is Cult of the Lamb. It is adorably sinister. It is Animal Crossing meets Helter Skelter, and it is out now for various gaming platforms.
Why does this sound like Search Party? Like the last season of Search Party?
Yeah. It's a little bit of that too.
Okay. So what's making me happy this week is another finale, although it's not a series finale. It's the season 2 finale of P-Valley. My goodness, we talked about this on the show. I love this show so much. And for me, the central relationship is the one between Lil Murda and Uncle Clifford. And I love this relationship. Uncle Clifford is a non-binary owner of The Pank, a strip club in the Mississippi Delta. And Lil Murda is a up-and-coming rapper. And they have this beautiful relationship. But there's a moment in the season 2 finale that like I've just gone back to over and over again where Lil Murda is performing at The Pank. He's performing this song called 7 Pounds of Pressure. It's hard. It's all about murdering people, but like, it's so catchy. And on top of that, you have Mercedes, who is one of the pole dancers there. She is bringing it. She's played by Brandi Evans, and Jay Alphonse Nicholson plays Lil Murda. And I just love that sequence, the aerial shots of her coming down the pole. It is fantastic. So if you are not watching P-Valley on Stars, you should do it. And that's what's making me happy. It's the season 2 finale, and everything that has to do with that show is just always making me happy. So if you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And that brings us to the end of our show. Eric Deggans, Glenn Weldon, thanks for being here and talking about Better Call Saul.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
This episode is produced by Candace Lim and Taylor Washington and edited by Mike Katziff. Hello, Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Ayesha Harris, and we'll see you all next week.